I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. As you probably know, the Pennsylvania primary is on April 26, almost 2 weeks away. And while the presidential candidates have been getting a lot of attention here on Radio Times, we have been focusing on two statewide races in Pennsylvania for the U.S. Senate and for the Attorney General. We've had a couple of candidates on, and we are literally waiting for our third candidate to join us here in our Philadelphia studio. But in the meantime, we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and tell us what you think about the race for both Attorney General and also for the U.S. Senate here in Pennsylvania. And I'm happy to say that our guest is sliding into the seat, just about to get him on the air here. And as you know, Democrats will have a chance to select a new nominee for Attorney General in Pennsylvania on April 26th. And this was after Kathleen Kane said she would not be seeking re-election. She has had her law license suspended and faces a criminal trial later this year. Three Democrats are vying to be their party's nominee: Stephen Zabala, who was a guest last week, Josh Shapiro, who will be joining us later this week, and John Morganelli, who is sitting down in front of me here in our Philadelphia studio. We're also featuring one-on-one interviews with the Republican candidates for Attorney General. I should add that John Morganelli has been the District Attorney of Northampton County since 1992, almost a quarter of a century. This is his fourth run for Pennsylvania Attorney General. And John Morganelli, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad I made it.
I'm glad you made it, too, because I was going to have to vamp for a while. This is the fourth time you've run for this job. Why do you want it so much?
Boy, I must really want it, right?
Why do you want it so much?
Well, you know, I've been a career prosecutor. As you've noted, I've been DA Northampton County for 24 years, elected seven times. I am actually Pennsylvania's most senior district attorney right now. And in 2008, I was a Democratic candidate for attorney general. Lost a relatively close race to Tom Corbett, about 52-47. He was the incumbent. And I never thought I'd run again, quite frankly. But Kathleen Kane's office went downhill, and I felt that this time this office really needs my experience. And so I ventured into the waters again. And it's a tough race because you're running against a fellow out of Montgomery County who's very popular, and my friend and colleague out in the West, Steve Zappala. And I'm stuck in the Lehigh Valley.
Well, but this is politics, and you're running for it. Well, tell us what you would do to address some of the stability issues in the Attorney General's office in Pennsylvania, and also some of the other issues related to Kathleen Kane and her tenure as Attorney General.
Well, you know, I think Ms. Kane got off to a good start. She did some good things, and then she got sidetracked. I think one of her main problems was going after political enemies, which is always a mistake in politics. You just forget about your enemies and you do the job, but she didn't do that. I think, first of all, we really do need to clean house at the top of the office. You know, at the top echelon of the office, we have a lot of holdovers from the Corbett administration. We have the Kane folks, many of them who have undermined their own boss in many ways. And I think that whoever is elected, and if I'm elected, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to take out the top echelon of the office. We're going to bring in new folks from all over Pennsylvania. I know a lot of young, aggressive prosecutors and some with gray hair like mine that could do a great job in that office. I served as president of the State DA's Association, and so I know a lot of the prosecutors throughout Pennsylvania, and we need to clean house, and we need to restore confidence in that office. And I think the way you do that is bringing in someone like myself, who is Pennsylvania's, you know, most experienced prosecutor. You know, I've tried 25 murder cases to verdict myself. I've testified before numerous boards and legislative committees over the years on criminal justice issues. I served on the Pennsylvania Commission on Crime for 6 years, so I learned the whole system upside down. And that's what's going to restore, I think, confidence and credibility.
Are you going to ask then for resignations of everyone that works in this office and then decide case by case who goes and who stays?
Yeah, I'm going to ask for the top echelon of the office. You know, there's a lot of
people.
What
do you mean, what's
well,
the top
what
echelon?
I'm talking about the leadership of the office and the, you know, we have a lot of lower level folks that do their job every day. They're agents on the streets. Some of them are protected by unions, and I certainly recognize and I respect the unions. I'm an old supporter of unions. I used to represent a union many years ago, so I recognize that we just can't carte blanche, throw people out of their jobs. But, you know, you have leadership which are basically at-will positions. Those are people like the chief deputy attorney general, the head of the criminal division. These are folks that are political appointments, essentially. And we have a lot of Corbett holdovers. It's time to get rid of them, time to bring in some new folks. And that's where I would start.
When you say they're Corbett holdovers and others, are you saying because of their political associations that disqualifies them for working for this office?
No, politics doesn't really enter into that office. In fact, in my office, I can't tell you who's a Democrat or a Republican. When we hire folks, I don't ever ask. It's not even relevant in my book. But I'm looking at bringing in fresh blood. And as I said, there's a lot of folks who've been in that office from the Corbett days, which is now, you know, a number of years ago. And the Kane folks, you know, have shown that they really aren't good at running the office. It's really in shambles in many ways. And morale is low. And I have friends who work there, former employees of mine who've worked there presently. And that's what I get back.
How do you deal with morale by firing people?
Well, because, you know, the fact of the matter is that the people who are on the street doing jobs, like the agents on the street and the lower level deputy attorney generals who are protected by union contracts, et cetera, they have no confidence in their leadership. And that's not going to change. Morale will improve when you bring in new leadership at the top, a new attorney general with experience, not someone like Josh Shapiro who has absolutely no criminal experience or civil experience for that matter. You need a prosecutor that the folks on the ground are going to look up to and say, this fellow knows, or woman, knows what to do in this job, has the experience, and is bringing in fresh faces that is not going to be bogged down by this whole scandal. I don't want anyone around who's, you know, involved in his email scandal or testify before grand juries or all of this nonsense that's going on. I want to bring in people that are want to do the job.
Speaking of email scandals, the special prosecutor, Doug Gansler from Maryland, has been looking through all these emails. I think there's something like a million of them. You have said you would fire this guy.
Well, you know, here's the thing. The fact of the matter is that there's been no allegation and no evidence. Even Kane herself, who knows what's in the emails, has not implied that there's any criminal activity here. We had two Supreme Court justices that have left office because of it. None of it's criminal. This is bad behavior. You don't spend $2 million of taxpayers' money hiring a special investigator or a special prosecutor to investigate bad behavior. What I would do, and I said this, and I was the first candidate to say this, and now everyone's saying it, let's let all these emails out in the public. Let's send them over to the disciplinary board for lawyers, to the judicial conduct board for judges, and let those investigators, which is why they get paid, to look at bad behavior and ethical violations. And then there's a remedies for that. We've seen the remedies. We've seen two justices resign, and that certainly is a big punishment. But you don't hire criminal investigators to investigate bad behavior. And this is pornography. It's reprehensible. Stuff that we know it's in these emails, but it's not a crime, and therefore you don't need a special criminal investigator.
What does it tell you, though, about the relationship between judges or justices in Pennsylvania and attorneys, some of whom are prosecutors, their cozy relationship that they would feel so comfortable exchanging some of these emails?
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is that lawyers become judges. And those friendships sometimes, you know, they continue. I mean, I have friends of mine who worked for me and who are judges today, and they're friends. And, you know, we may go out to dinner, et cetera. We don't discuss cases, which is improper. We don't have ex parte communications. But those friendships do survive the fact that they're now a judge or a justice of the Supreme Court. I don't have a problem with them exchanging emails. What I have a problem with is the content of the emails. They're you know, something that you shouldn't be doing. It's just not right. It's not good behavior. It's not appropriate. And particularly in the criminal justice system and using state computers, it's even worse. So, you know, I think that if there was allegations here that there was case fixing going on, it'd be a whole different ballgame. But that's not the case.
Kathleen Kane has said this is an example of the old boys network that's alive and well in Pennsylvania. Do you agree with that assessment?
I don't think that she's completely wrong about that. I do think that there was disdain for Ms. Kane. She was the first Democrat elected, and the Republicans have controlled this office since it became elected in 1980, so they didn't really want a Democrat in there. And then she was a female on top of it, which is probably was not making the Republican hierarchy happy. And I do think there was an effort to undermine her, but she helped them. You know, she did some crazy things, misjudgments, I think, largely because of her lack of experience. And she helped them. And, you know, I hope that she comes out of this well. You know, I'm hoping that she's not convicted of any crimes. I don't know whether she committed a crime. That's up to a jury to decide. But I do think that she's not completely wrong, that there was that element of some of the individuals, if you want to call them good old boys or not, but they were people that controlled that office from administration to administration because the Republicans controlled it and the same folks worked there. And when she got in there, she disrupted that whole situation.
So you think it was political? I mean, it was about her being a Democrat?
I think it was political. I think that there was groups that tried to undermine her early on. But I think she helped them because she made some serious misjudgments. For example, you know, sending this information to a reporter and then it turns out to be grand jury material. You know, I learned lessons in politics. You know, we all have our political enemies. And when you run for things, people like you. Some people don't like you. But once you get elected, you got to put this aside. You know, you cannot worry about your detractors. And she worried about her detractors and she tried to get even with them and having fights with, you know, district attorney in Philadelphia and other folks. And it just ruined her, unfortunately.
If elected, what would you say is the top priority beyond, as you say, kind of cleaning up the attorney general's office?
Well, I think that there, you know, I'm really concerned about violent crime in our cities. I think what you're seeing in across Pennsylvania, not just in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, but in cities like where I live, Bethlehem and Allentown, violent crime's on a rise again. And we need to address the whole issue of guns. I have proposed that we institute a regulation by attorney general regulation that would make it mandatory for lost and stolen guns to be reported to law enforcement. Now, we're never going to get this through the legislature.
Well, that was tried a couple of years ago.
Well, it was tried because it was tried by ordinances in various cities. It was tried in the legislature, but it failed. But the attorney general has powers to issue safety regulations under the consumer powers of its office. And it has the same force and effect as law. If I'm attorney general, I'm going to put a regulation that says lost or stolen handguns must be reported to law enforcement. It has the same force and effect as if passed by the legislature. That's number one. I want to bring a gun trafficking unit back into the office and make it work again. It worked for a while. It sort of waned a little bit. But, you know, when you go to cities like Philadelphia, which I went to Villanova Law School, okay, so and my son's a Villanova grad. And I spend a lot of time in Philadelphia. My daughter lives and works in Philadelphia right down the street on Market Street. So I care about Philadelphia, particularly in southeast Pennsylvania. You know, we see a lot of guns on our streets and we see police officers at risk. And, you know, we have to assure that our officers are safe on our streets. And it's not the law-abiding citizens who have a permit to carry. It's the criminals who are able to access these guns through gun traffickers. So we need to address that issue. And one other issue that I'm big on.
You know what? Hold on to that only because we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's John Morganelli, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's currently the district attorney of Northampton County and he is running for the Democratic nomination for attorney general. The April primary is April 26th, almost 2 weeks away. And this is a series of one-on-one interviews that we've been doing on Radio Times for candidates running for statewide office here in Pennsylvania. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. If you're just joining us, John Morganelli is our guest and one of the Democratic candidates for attorney general here in Pennsylvania, one of three Democratic candidates running for the nomination. And again, he has served as district attorney of Northampton County since 1992. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments as we carry on our conversation? I ran across a quote. This was in the Philadelphia Inquirer. You said, if elected, you would be an advocate for a law holding parents and caregivers of children and the mentally ill criminally and civilly liable if their dependents commit a crime with their gun. Can you flesh that out for
us? Yeah, I proposed a while back the Parents Responsible Gun Ownership Act. And simply what it would say is this. If you're a gun owner and in your home you have someone who's mentally ill, or is a child under the age of 18, you have a higher duty to keep your firearm inaccessible. You know, a lot of the crimes that we see committed by the mentally ill and kids in schools, they get their guns from home. And that's because these guns are easily accessible. So if you are a gun owner, you have a higher duty of care if you have in your home mentally ill folks or kids. Now, if you don't, if you're just living there by yourself or your spouse or your significant other, you can leave your loaded shotgun on a kitchen table every night if you'd like. But I'd like to see this law pass, and if that gun shows up in a crime by someone in your household, then you could be held criminally and or civilly liable. I think it would be a great deterrence to allowing your guns to be left to these types of folks who commit crime.
You said civilly or criminally.
Correct.
How would you tell the difference?
Well, the civil case means you could be sued for money, and that could be done pretty much even without this law. But the criminal sanctions would be the ones that I would be wanting to impose, that you could be, you know, cited for recklessness in terms of your firearm placement because you allow your child. Now, if it's locked in a cabinet somewhere and they break in, well, you know, then you did your best. But, you know, we see that these guns are so accessible by kids, the mentally ill, the gun owners. Some of them have 20, 30 guns in their houses, and these kids go and they take them to school, and they, you know, ends up in a huge tragedy.
How about holding gun companies liable? That's been an issue that's been around for some time, basically saying that if someone perhaps or perhaps there are gun companies that are flooding a certain area and thereby increasing people's access to guns, that they have some liability for the problem that they allegedly have created. Where do you stand on something like
that? Yeah, I'm not in favor of suits against gun manufacturers because, you know, the fact is the criminal commits the crime, and it's the folks who allow people access to these guns when they shouldn't, like mentally ill and kids, and then the criminal who pulls the trigger. I mean, holding gun manufacturers liable because their guns used in the crime is sort of like holding car manufacturers liable for drunk driving. You know, the fact is a gun is a product that people use responsibly, can use responsibly. Target shooting, sports, self-defense, keeping your home secure. But when it's used in a crime, you can't hold the manufacturer of the implement. Otherwise, we'd be holding knife manufacturers liable for stabbing crimes. I just don't think that that's a good place to go.
A number of people have talked about the opioid crisis in Pennsylvania. It's across the country where people have access to prescription drugs and then they run out of that or they end up using heroin because it's available and it's a lot cheaper. How do you address something like that?
Well, there's a plan in my platform to talk specifically about that. Pennsylvania went from 14 to 7 in drug overdose deaths in the recent time. There's a couple of things that I proposed. One is what we're doing through the DA's Association, of course, which is the naloxone access. All law enforcement has to have it to save lives. But I also would like to see the prescription drug monitoring program in the Attorney General's office expand it, expanding the types of drugs monitored to include Schedule 2 through Schedule 4 drugs. This is a statewide program that collects information about controlled prescription drugs because, as you just noted, lots of folks get hooked on prescription drugs, and then they go out and they buy heroin because it's a lot cheaper. We also need to do more drug treatment courts, which I have supported. And I've also advocated that we go into the communities with a huge education program from the AG's office throughout the state to talk more about the dangers of opiate, because I think a lot of folks think that these prescription drugs aren't as harmful as they are, and we need to educate as well. Lastly, we need to stop the poison from coming in our streets.
How do you do that?
Well, that's tough enforcement. I just arrested last week in Northampton County three folks for killing someone by delivering drugs. It's called drug delivery resulting in death. It's a homicide case. And you got to attack these people who are profiting and poisoning our kids and other folks in our communities. I also would like to see the Attorney General's office form a transnational gang unit, because lots of the drugs that come in, and I would say 99.9% of the drugs that come in to Pennsylvania come in through Mexico, through our southern border, and are driven to Pennsylvania by trucks. We need transnational gangs to attack these gangs that are going outside Pennsylvania, and it's actually international gangs. We need to focus on that, because a gang is only a criminal enterprise making money.
Isn't that the job of the federal government, though? I mean, well, should Pennsylvania get involved in transnational drug
shipments? I think that Pennsylvania needs to, and I think that other states are recognizing that these gangs go across state borders. And, you know, the feds do some of this stuff. But quite frankly, in the age of terrorism, which we live in now, a lot of our federal resources are rightfully focused on terrorism activities. And my work with the federal agencies often suggests to me that we need to be doing more so that they can free up their resources to do more for those types of issues, terrorist issues.
Do you want to prosecute healthcare providers who prescribe or perhaps overprescribe painkillers?
Well, we've done it. I mean, it is done. When you have a healthcare provider that is writing script after script after script, I mean, it's a reckless act. And there's a compliance section in the Attorney General's office that monitors this. And even district attorneys like myself have brought cases against physicians for this kind of negligence, really. It's a reckless conduct, and they can be brought to criminal liability for such actions. Not that I want to arrest all of our docs, because the docs do a great job, and we need them. But I'm saying that there are folks out there that just keep writing script after script, and they're part of the problem.
That's John Morganelli. He is running for the Democratic nomination for Attorney General here in Pennsylvania, one of three Democrats running for that nomination. We are also featuring interviews with the Republican Attorney General candidates as well, all this before the April 26th primary. And we felt it was important on Radio Times to focus on statewide races. So much of the attention related to the April 26th primary has to do with the presidential race, but they're important local races that certainly affect us here in the Delaware Valley and across the state as well. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I do want to read some comments, but let me first get David from Flemington, New Jersey. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty. My question is, how does an attorney general ensure effective enforcement of laws against use of handheld cell phones on all types of roads while operating a motor vehicle? And is there publicly available information on the effectiveness of enforcing these laws?
You're talking about distracted driving, David?
I'm talking about using handheld cell phones while driving. And I guess just two questions. How, in the Attorney General's role, do they ensure that the police at all levels, on all of the various roads of a given state, how do they ensure that people are stopped or, I guess, ticketed for use of cell phones? And how do they reduce these rates? And are these rates and the success of law enforcement, is that information publicly available?
Well, David, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You see this as an important issue. This is about, I believe, what David is talking about, our distracted drivers. We see them every day.
Yeah, well, first of all, the Attorney General would probably have very little to no role in this issue. We do have a law in Pennsylvania that essentially makes it an offense to text and drive and be on cell phones. You know, it was passed statewide, and there was a time when the municipalities were trying to pass them individually, and that didn't work so well. But we do have a statewide law now. It's enforced by the Pennsylvania State Police. The problem with it is that we often don't see it enforced until there's an accident and a tragedy, because it's sometimes hard to enforce this. You know, you'd have to sort of look inside the vehicle. People are using handheld devices now, which is more responsible, obviously, and complies. But it is a problem. We've seen the stats stacking up a little bit. I see it all the time of people, driving down here. My driver was on his cell phone. I told him to stop, because I don't want to be in an accident.
Did you issue a citation?
Yeah, I didn't issue one, but I said you can't do that with me here, so that's out. But I do see it. It's a problem, but it is addressed by the state police, and there's sporadic enforcement, but it's not as strong as it should be, perhaps.
Which means perhaps there should be a just more effective education campaign?
I think the folks know about it, but everyone thinks they can do both.
We have a tweet from 425. I'm not sure I totally understand it. If there's evidence of child trafficking now, why isn't it being handed over to the Attorney General? Now, is there child? I mean, there is child trafficking.
Well, I think
is there
that
not in
there is child trafficking. I mean, we have laws on the books to deal with this. There's task forces that are working actively in Pennsylvania, and that includes even in my county, in Lehigh Valley. We work with state police on this issue. It goes on. I mean, it's an ongoing stuff that we do. And when we find it, you know, we charge. There's lots of investigations going on. So I think the AG's office is involved in this. They have a child predator unit, and they work very closely with state police and local law enforcement in the DA's offices.
And they've been pretty aggressive, have they not, on this particular issue?
Yes, they have been, yes.
Let me ask you about medical marijuana, even recreational marijuana. We were talking about the problem of heroin addiction or opioid addiction. Where do you stand on those other two issues related to marijuana?
Well, I'm in favor of medical marijuana as long as there's support and there seems to be from the medical community that it can be useful for certain people suffering from various ailments and going through cancer treatments or whatever. So I would support it. I think it should probably pass. As far as the recreational use, I'm in favor of decriminalization, but not legalization. Legalization is when you can go out and anybody can buy marijuana, and it's like Colorado. I don't think that's a good thing because I don't really see the benefit of having more people high, driving, more people high walking around. Right now, because it is a crime, a lot of people don't use marijuana. People don't use drugs because it is a crime. I think if you legalize it, you're going to open it up, and more people who never even thought about it will start to use it. I don't think that's good. On the flip side, though, I support decriminalization. I think right here in Philadelphia, the DA's done that. It seems to be working, I think, in other parts of the state. And that is, it's not legal, but if you get caught with a small amount, you're going to get a citation and it'll be treated sort of like a traffic offense or a parking ticket. You pay a fine, but you don't get fingerprinted. You don't go to jail. You don't go in the criminal justice system. And I think that's probably where we should be, and I would support that. I think that's a reasonable approach.
The idea – so it's sort of a half a crime? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's more or less like, you know, it's not – you're going to get a fine and you're going to pay a you know, citation, like parking offense. But it's not going to be that you're fingerprinted and photographed and you're going through the system for a small amount. That doesn't mean, though, that the dealers who are selling the stuff still would be prosecuted.
Let me read a comment from Zeke. He says, what is your feeling on juvenile or close to juvenile lifers in light of the recent Supreme Court decision? Should those people be released? And this was basically saying that if you're committing a violent crime as a juvenile, you can't spend the rest of your life in prison.
Right. The law has recently been changed. It was that if you had a juvenile, you know, who committed first-degree murder, they could get life and they would serve a life sentence. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has rolled that back, and Pennsylvania has obviously filed suit. So what we have now essentially is a situation where there's a sentencing hearing. It's not an automatic life sentence like it was. And a judge, a common pleas judge, could impose a sentence anywhere from, you know, 10 years, 20 years up to life. It could still be up to life. But now there has to be – it's not an automatic sentence as it once was. I don't have a problem with that. I think that the – you know, we recognize that someone who's 12 or 13 or 14 or 15 or 16 years old is not mature, and maybe 20 years in prison is enough. Maybe 30 years, but, you know, maybe not necessarily life. You give someone hope to get out if they're older and they change. So it was a change in our law, but I think most of the prosecutors are rolling with it, such as myself. And that doesn't mean that a judge still could not impose a life sentence if they found this particular juvenile had a bad record or was not salvageable. I think they could still do that.
Why so many, though, juvenile lifers in Pennsylvania? I forget the exact number, but it's way up there.
Well, the reason why is because we have what's called second-degree murder in Pennsylvania. And we have first-degree, which is an intentional crime, and we have two potential punishments. We have a death penalty. We have life without parole. And then we have what's called second-degree murder, which is a felony murder. If you commit a bank robbery, in the course of the robbery, you know, you kill someone, even though that wasn't your intent. Your intention was to rob the bank, but you killed somebody on the way out. That's subject right now in Pennsylvania to life without parole. So it's the same sentence. So what you have are a lot of young folks who maybe got involved in felony crimes. They actually didn't pull a trigger killing anyone, but they were part of a conspiracy to commit a felony. Someone died, and they got second-degree life. And there they are serving a life sentence. There's lots of movement about amending that crime as well, and we have not weighed in on that yet.
And what did you make of the Kids for Cash scandal that came out of Luzerne County? What did that, or what does that tell us about our juvenile justice system?
Well, it's terrible. The Kids for Cash scandal was terrible. We had judges who were on the take, corrupt judges. We had, you know, I just don't like the whole idea of people profiting from, you know, incarcerating kids. It's these private prisons. I've never supported privatization. of I think that the public, you know, institutions have to run to our prisons. These were privatization of juvenile facilities. People made money on them.
And kids had maybe 90 seconds where they could defend themselves without a lawyer.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was the whole system was corrupt up there. And, you know, people went to jail, rightfully so. And I think that that sort of has come to an end now. But it's just another example of the corruption in our system, which has to be rooted out. And that's why I think when you're voting for an attorney general, we're not voting for an office manager. We're not looking for someone, you know, who's going to come in and administrate. I mean, we all do that in our jobs as DA. But you need a prosecutor who can make judgments about where do we put our resources? Are we going to go after the corrupt politicians? And that's my experience. You know, we go after public corruption, street crime. I've been in the grand jury. I've run numerous grand juries over the years. I know how they work. We have statewide grand juries in the attorney general's office. And it's a prosecution office. That's what it is. 75% of the resources are allocated to criminal law enforcement. And that's what the office does. Drug enforcement, child predators. Who better than to have the most experienced district attorney in Pennsylvania? Me.
I thought you would say that. We're about a minute before our second break here. Kathleen Kane, a couple of years ago, said she would not defend what it was at that time, Pennsylvania's marriage laws, feeling that they were unconstitutional. Are there laws in Pennsylvania that you would not uphold, that you would take a stand on?
I agreed with Ms. Kane on that because I think that, and she turned out to be right, by the way, that the law was discriminatory. Under the Commonwealth Attorneys Act, which guides the Attorney General, Attorney Generals are supposed to defend the constitutionality of state statutes. However, there is wiggle room. First of all, as a lawyer, I believe that I raise my hand and I swear to uphold the Constitution. If I feel that a law is unconstitutional, I don't think I can in good conscience enforce it. And if I found that a law discriminated on race, gender, sexual orientation, as she did, I would not enforce it. I think that the fact is most of the laws passed by the legislature pass constitutional muster. But if we have a renegade legislature and they trample on the rights of a particular group, I would not enforce it.
And that's John Morganelli, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, one of three Democrats running for the nomination for Attorney General here in Pennsylvania. There are two Republicans running as well, and all of them will be guests on Radio Times by the time the primary rolls around, which is in 2 weeks, almost 2 weeks, on April 26th. 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments here. Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with John Morganelli. Since 1992, he's been the district attorney of Northampton County in Pennsylvania. This is his fourth run for attorney general, one of three Democrats running for the nomination. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a couple of comments. An email from Matt. He says, could you please be more specific about what you mean by mentally ill committing violent crimes with guns using examples and statistics? This is picking up on what we said earlier.
Well, I think that, I don't have all the stats here in front of me in the radio station, but I think whenever we hear about a tragedy, you know, someone walks into a campus and commits a mass shooting, walks into a movie theater, almost inevitably right after the crime, what do we learn? We learn that this person has had a history of mental illness, suffering from various degrees of mental illness, could be a number of bipolar, whatever. And what we've learned is that this person had easy access to firearms. So my point here is this. You know, when you are a gun owner and you have in your home someone that you know is mentally ill, that is suffering, is being treated for mental illness, you have a higher duty to make sure that person doesn't have access to a gun and cause harm to someone. I mean, this is what we see in shooting after shooting after shooting. It's inevitable. Every time we arrest someone or they end up shooting themselves and they commit suicide at the crime scene, it's because they are suffering from some type of serious mental illness. And you know what? We don't have the resources anymore. We need more resources to treat our mentally ill. I've been a big advocate. We can't lock everybody up in jail. I mean, there's a lot of folks out there that don't get mental health treatment anymore. And that's part of this criminal justice system. Is let's help these folks keep out of the criminal justice system.
Well, I know what you're saying, but would it be a diagnosed someone if they were diagnosed with some kind of mental illness, then their parents would be held either criminally or civilly liable.
Yeah, I mean, if there's a history of treatment here, you know, if you're having someone that's in and out of the hospital, they're suffering from a diagnosable mental illness and the family knows it, not that it was a surprise, you know, and we see this all the time. They interview the neighbors, they interview the parents. Oh, my God, he was, you know, seeing a psychiatrist. And yet they had a whole room full of guns accessible for this fellow. So, and I think that gun owners have a higher responsibility in that regard. So that's my view of it.
A comment from Rob. He says, what are you going to do about holding prosecutors liable if they engage in misconduct? How will you ensure that the rights of criminals and prison inmates are upheld?
That's a great question. You know, I think the worst thing is when we have corruption, who are corrupt prosecutors. And we've seen a few over the years, and they've been, you know, brought to justice. You know, in my years as DA, I've arrested at least 45 to 50 police officers for various crimes. Some of them from as far, you know, like DUIs, but up to sexual assaults, including bribery. I actually tried a case against the chief of police in one of our jurisdictions on bribery charges and convicted him. So I'm not afraid to bring charges against law enforcement officials when necessary. We need to instill confidence in our system. One of the things I want to do is fix the broken parts of our system. You know, we've lost a whole two generations of folks that can't get a job because of a nonviolent criminal record. Now, Governor Wolf recently tried to amend that by allowing more crimes to be expunged, but it didn't go far enough. I'd like to see some nonviolent felonies be expunged. Someone commits a burglary when they're 18 years old, now they're 30, they can't get a job. You know, when they walked into a place to steal a case of soda, and now it's a burglary conviction, felony. You know, I think those folks need a second chance. And I think with someone like me who's tough on violent crime, and I do want the violent criminals locked up, by the way. In fact, I support Governor Rendell's plan. When Governor Rendell was governor, his plan was to deny parole to repeat violent felons. You know why he came up with that? Because a police officer was shot here in Philadelphia and killed by a repeat violent felon. And he had enough. And he said, you know what? Repeat violent felons, parole, no parole. You stay in jail for 20 years. You get out when you're 50 years old. There aren't too many gang members running around the streets at age 50. Crime and violent crime is a young man's game. It's between the ages of like 15 and 35. And so you got to take these violent criminals off the streets. But at the same time, let's fix the broken parts of our justice system and give people a second chance.
What about the death penalty? It actually has not been carried out since 1999. Governor Wolf has a commission that's taking a look at it. I understand the report or some kind of report will be out perhaps later this year. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I've supported the death penalty for certain types of first-degree murder. It's not for every first-degree murder, and it's only for first-degree murder. If you commit an intentional crime and you fit the aggravating factors, which the legislature has set forth, I mean, I've tried death penalty cases. I've stood before juries and asked them to return a death penalty, and I actually obtained two death penalty verdicts. One was a guy who committed a quadruple murder. He had killed a man in 1993, served 15 years, got out on parole, and within 2 weeks he stabbed four more people to death, his girlfriend, her father, her grandfather, and next-door neighbor. Now, what do you do with a man who committed five murders? In my view, you put him on death row and you execute him. He admitted his guilt. So I support it. But all the candidates for attorney general in this race support the death penalty. Mm-hmm. I'm not in favor of Governor Wolf's moratorium because I believe that it's just a stall. We have 200-some people on death row. And 99.9% of them admit that they committed the crime. There's no issues of innocence for these folks. They admitted that they committed the crime.
You'd like them all to be executed?
Well, I think that if the juries gave them death verdicts and the Supreme Court held up their case and the federal courts upheld their case and it went to the U.S. Supreme Court and 20 years have gone by now and they've admitted their guilt and that's the sentence, we have to carry out the sentence. Now, that's the law. But we've had delays in Pennsylvania. And, you know, I think that the delays are not warranted for the folks who admitted their guilt and who have had their cases reviewed about 15, 20 times by every court that you can imagine.
I mean, what you're saying is that since Pennsylvania has a death penalty, and we do, and the death penalty was then legalized or made constitutional back in 1976, you're saying let's carry it out.
Well, that was the case of Blystone. Yes, it was determined to be constitutional, and it should be carried out after a numerous reviews of the case. And as I said, you know, we have folks who say they were not guilty. Let's take them aside and hold those cases. But what about the 200 folks who said, yes, I did this murder, I was crazy, and the jury didn't buy it, they have some defense, but it wasn't that I didn't do it, and the jury has ruled, and the courts have, on the appellate courts, have upheld the appeals, denied the appeals. Well, then at some point, if we have a law, it has to be carried out. Governor Wolf's a friend of mine. He was at my house twice, but I don't agree with him on this issue.
But if people are crazy or say they're crazy, is that not a mitigating circumstance?
Well, that's for the jury to decide. And if the jury listens, you know, to the evidence and determines that these people are feigning mental illness, which they sometimes do, you know, you have a guy who goes out and kills someone and then, you know, they had no history of mental illness, but now all of a sudden they're crazy. You know, it wasn't like they were treating for years and it was a recognized situation. So every case has to be judged on its individual facts.
Let me read a comment from Peter and then we'll get some more callers in. D.A. Morganelli has run a low-profile campaign compared to the others, didn't show up at a state committee meeting, no contact information on the website. Last I checked, it was difficult to find the website in a race with opponents using all types of media. Does it make sense to not use these types that are so cheap? What would it cost to send an email? I'm a supporter, but it doesn't look good on the ground. Go ahead, John Morganelli.
You know, I have a website. It's www.johnmorganelli.com. It has my platform on it. It's there. I mean, I was at state committee, Democratic state committee. I was there. We are running a campaign. You know, we're phoning voters. We're on television here in Philly and across Pennsylvania starting yesterday. We're here on a radio today with you. But, you know, the fact of the matter is Pennsylvania is a large state, and I have two opponents who have millions of dollars. I'm the underfunded candidate, and they have $2 million, and I have, you know, like $700,000. So I have to conserve resources for the last couple of weeks, and that's what we're doing. But, you know, I appreciate this person still for me. But the fact of the matter is that these kind of races are pretty much, because Pennsylvania is so big, are media-based. We're on social media. You know, we've paid Facebook messaging and stuff. But it's such a big, big lift. It's not like running for city council. It's running for statewide. I mean, it's like taking a gallon of water out of the Atlantic Ocean. It doesn't make that much difference unless you're on television.
And radio.
And radio.
Let me get Phil.
Which is why I'm here with you, Marty.
Phil from Frankfurt to join our conversation. Hi, Phil. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm a Episcopal minister in the Frankfurt section of Philadelphia, which is the 15th police district, and that's the largest and busiest police district in Philadelphia. I'm also a law enforcement officer with over 20 years experience. And I wanted to ask you about the drugs and drug arrests, drug enforcement. To me, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. The term the war on drugs was coined by President Nixon about 40 years ago. I don't see much of a change in the way that we have been handling drugs in this country. There's no real difference in what we see on the street. And so I'm trying to see if you're interested in looking at alternatives, some of which have been tried and seem to be successful in New England, where they are pairing law enforcement and treatment together and having some much sure. better results and trying to arrest their way out of it.
Phil, I appreciate the call. Go ahead, John Morganelli.
This gentleman is absolutely correct. The war on drugs has been a huge failure, and we are still doing it the way they did it 40 years ago. I'm open to new ideas. I think drug treatment and rehabilitation is necessary. When I was president of the State DA's Association, I advocated for $10 million in Governor Ridge's budget to add more drug treatment in our prisons. I think we have to have new approaches. It's not working. It's not working at all. We have more people addicted to drugs. That's why I'm not in favor of legalization. I'm afraid that we're going to have more people addicted to drugs. But you're absolutely right. You know, I'm open to hearing more from folks who are trying to come up with some alternatives. We're sort of stuck in a rut. And in the meantime, we are trying to arrest the drug dealers, and we continue to do that. As soon as we put them in jail, there's people there to take their place because it's a supply and demand problem. It's a supply and demand problem. How do we get people to get off drugs? And that's a huge problem right now. Plus the international aspect, drugs coming in from Mexico. And that's where they all come from, I hate to say. But that's where they're coming across that border. Yes, I'm open to new ideas. And I'm somewhat familiar with what's going on in New England. Someone gave me an article, and I think it's on my desk to review. I just took a quick look at it. But yes, I think we ought to start looking at those things.
Phil, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Matt from Limerick has to say. Matt, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to back up the discussion a little bit to where you guys were talking about prescription painkillers and holding doctors criminally liable for overwriting them. My situation is I'm a 43-year-old general contractor. I have a form of arthritis that's going to eventually leave me a cripple. And so I live my life in daily pain, and I take prescription painkillers. And basically what I have to do, because they're so cautious about how they give them out, is I have to decide when and how much of my life I want to be in pain and divide it up like that much in that way. So I wonder if it's too much of a one-size-fits-all to where a doctor like my rheumatologist basically needs to write those type of drugs to every one of his patients, because we all live in constant pain, where maybe a general practitioner doesn't need to, and is it looked at differently on different levels, or is it kind of across the board?
No, I hear you, Matt. No, I appreciate the call. John Morganelli, go
ahead. Yeah, this is a delicate balance that law enforcement has to look at. You know, as I said, right now we have a statewide program that collects information about controlled substance prescription drugs. Dispensers of the drugs are required to collect and submit information to the prescription drug monitoring program within 72 hours. And this helps healthcare professionals identify individuals who might be in need of substance abuse treatment. So the monitoring is done for also to monitor the doctors, but also to find out folks who might have problems that are leading to more addiction. I understand this gentleman's point of view. Look, we don't want to penalize the docs who are treating their patients responsibly. But there are obligations that you just can't have someone become so medicated and addicted to these painkillers that they can't function, and then they go out looking for more on the streets because the doc says, sorry, you got your prescription, and I can't write any more for you, and now they've got their fellows out on the streets. Right. So that's what we're looking at. It's a delicate balance, and I don't think it's one size fits all.
A couple of comments here. One from Dana. She says, what do you think about the undue burden state laws are putting on women's right to safe and legal abortion? And this is before the House in Harrisburg, which would, if passed, and the governor says he wouldn't sign it, but if signed, would actually prohibit abortions after 20 weeks.
You know, I'm a pro-life Democrat, and here's my position on it. I believe that abortion it should be only available for cases of rape, incest, life of the mother, and extreme fetal deformity. However, Roe v. Wade is our law. I don't want to see us tampering with that law by having some state statute now, you know, move in the opposite direction of Roe v. Wade. So I'm very little concerned about what I'm reading about this new legislation that's moving. We have an Abortion Control Act in Pennsylvania. Governor Casey back in the day, it seems to be working rather well. So, you know, unless the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, which I don't think is likely, you know, I'm really skeptical of trying to erode Roe v. Wade by state legislation. So I need to look at this. But even though I'm pro-life, I'm a little suspicious about having state laws somehow, which will be against what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Roe v. Wade. That's the law of the land, and I accept it.
A quick question here. A caller we couldn't take had a question about fracking, and I was reading about the Environmental Crimes Unit within the Office of the Attorney General. Do you see the potential problems associated with fracking?
Well, I think there are problems that are already occurring, and the fact is that the environmental law section of the AG's office is severely underfunded. You know, we work with them. We refer cases to them. They hardly ever bring criminal prosecutions. I think there's only two in the last number of years. And so what I would like to see done is, yes, a beefing up of the environmental law section so that we can take a look at what the effects of fracking are, and also prosecute if there are criminal law violations, not just handle these civilly. What happens up there is mostly civil treatment of these matters rather than criminal because of lack of resources.
Well, John Morganelli, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And John Morganelli, one of three Democrats running for the nomination for Attorney General. Last week, Zappala was our guest. And on Thursday, we've got Shapiro coming in. And we will be talking to the Republicans also running for the nomination. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. But don't go away. We've got much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.